Welcome to Nothing Is Real, a podcast about the Beatles. Everybody thinks they know the Beatles, but how much do we really know? My name is Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And we're live on tape from Dublin and Belfast and Boston because we are joined by noted music journalist and ESP researcher Solomon Davies. Hello, Solomon.
Hello.
Now, many people since 1970 and the end of the Beatles' recording career have issued reinterpretations of the Beatles' music, but we're here today because this is the first known evidence of an album of pre-interpretations of Beatles' music, because April the 1st sees the release of The Music of the Beatles as channeled in 1958 by the Echo Lake Home for the Potentially Clairvoyant. And Solomon, this is something that you've been intimately involved in bringing to the masses, is that right?
Yeah, this is a groundbreaking, shocking discovery that will just change how people view not only Beatles, but how the brain works as well forever. We have found audio proof of a group of psychics in the late 50s in Vermont somehow channeling future Beatles songs and recording them.
This seems very hard to believe, but this is now what's been captured on this album, The Music of the Beatles, as channeled in 1958, and the science behind it seems quite remarkable.
Yes, I'm a noted ESP researcher, and I'm very skeptical to start, as always, and the further I dug into this, I couldn't explain what exactly was going on, and so there seems to be one obvious takeaway, and that's that these channelers were somehow able to reach into the future and pull these songs back to the past.
I'm looking through you. Where did she go? I thought I knew you. What did I know? You don't look different, buddy. I've changed. I'm looking through you. You're not the same.
So not only, listening in as clairvoyance, but what we might describe as oral precognitive clairvoyance, or APCs. This seems totally logical to me, Stephen. Do you have any questions? Do you have any problems with any of this?
I'm a believer. I've been listening to this, and it definitely sounds to me like it was comes from 1958. And I'm not behind the science. I'm not across the ESP, but you know, being from Ireland, we're believers. We believe in these things. Yeah, it's absolutely fascinating.
This is the only show brave enough to present this material, and I want to commend you. Nothing is real.
The truth is out there. Well, if anything, we are known as one of the lead clairvoyant podcasts out there on the internet, and we love a good conspiracy theory, don't we, Stephen?
We're very fond of conspiracy theories, and people do often say, you know, we believe anything. So we're here for you.
But wait a sec, Stephen. I'm just kind of rubbing my screen here and looking at the people who are in on this call, and I'm pretty certain this isn't music writer and ESP researcher Solomon Davies. I'm pretty certain that there's two people on this call with us today, that it's Ryan Walsh and Robert Johansson, who seem to be somewhat involved in this project. What is going on here, gentlemen?
All right, it's all good fun, folks. I didn't mean to mislead you. Rob, you take it away. Tell them what we've done.
April Fool's.
April Fool's. Gosh, and you all believed us up until this moment.
Now, Ryan and I, like during the pandemic, we decided we wanted to make this project about the Beatles because we're both fans of the Beatles. And we worked together a long time ago because I moved to New York, and back in Boston, we had a band together, and we made this one album called
Complete Recordings of Dust Johnson. This is like 20 years ago.
Yeah, 20 years ago, it made this recording called The Complete Recordings of Dust Johnson, made it like over one long evening, like deep into the night, where we tried to create all the recordings of this strange Appalachian character that we had found these special recordings. And it became this kind of cult thing, like people in Boston knew about the album. And I think people different places as well, right? Because Ryan, you put
it
online.
I would put it into download sites, and I would shove it into CD orders that I got, and you know, and so people had it, but I hadn't heard. No one had brought it up to me or Rob in about 20 years. But someone asked for it, emailed, and I was so tickled by it. I sent the email to Rob, and I was like, this kind of dovetails with another idea I had. What if we faked old Beatles songs sounding like they were recorded before they existed? That's just, the whole concept is troublesome, and I loved it. And that's, we started from there.
And just in case anyone's confused, we should state that this is an album that's been released on April the 1st on Bandcamp. And it is called The Music of the Beatles, as channeled in 1958 by the Echo Lake Home for the Potentially Clairvoyant. And there's a remarkable backstory attached to all of this, which, you know, one must... It's got the air of Percy Thrillington about it, I have to say, you know.
There is a lot of work has gone into setting this up, I have to say.
Yes.
You know, we've established that this emerged from the... You know, the pandemic, you know, we can blame the pandemic for lots of things, and we can blame this on the pandemic as well. But did the idea come for doing, you know, let's just fake up some recordings in 58 style first? Or did Ryan start working up this? I was going to say sleeve notes, but sleeve notes doesn't do it justice. It's like a novella you've created by way of a backstory.
Right.
We started with this idea of a podcast, actually, that we were going to make a fictional podcast that was going to tell this story, and went and did episode outlines for the whole thing, but then realized it was going to be a very expensive endeavor because of
rights. Right, yes. Yeah. We spend a fortune on ours.
I was going to say, you're the only two middle-aged white men not to have a podcast, you know. So this, sorry, I'm calling you middle-aged. I'm much older than you are, but
We're middle-aged.
So the idea was to do a podcast, but then, as we know as well, yes, the cost of that is
It's exorbitant.
And the story was different. It wasn't this, but it had tones of this. But it also was like, it wasn't as playful and fun, because that one, someone else really did write the songs we discovered. And we were like, that's, it feels bad to even fictionally take that away from the lads. And so, and then we realized, just a straight covers album, you compulsory covers license, that covers it. And then we were off, but it was always the Beatles.
Where did you first encounter the Beatles? You know, I mean, I know they're just kind of all pervasive. They're just out there in the atmosphere. But was it kind of when you were kids or?
Yeah, for me, it was when the anthologies came out. So in the 90s, because my parents didn't really listen to the Beatles. They listened to more like folk, like Simon and Garfunkel and things like that. And then, but once those anthologies came out and there was all this kind of Beatle mania again, I became completely obsessed. And for a year, I think I only listened to the Beatles.
Yeah.
And just went through all of the albums over and over again. And, you know, first I liked the early stuff, and then I liked the later stuff, and now I like the middle stuff.
Because you're middle-aged.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm going to have to keep apologizing for that all the way through this podcast. But so, yeah, there's a friend of mine came to the Beatles in much the same way, and he... Because he arrived at, sort of landed on anthology, he regards those as being the definitive versions. So particularly with anthology 2 and 3, where you got the Escher demos and stuff like that. So when he hears the finished versions, he thinks that doesn't sound quite right. That's not how I remember it.
Right.
And I think is that the same thing? Because there is a sort of hint of Escher demos about what we're listening to here on this.
I think, well, it's, first of all, I mean, that was the anthology, the TV version was like the most brilliant propaganda. my story is similar. But those, I found those anthology collections, like I was like, wait, what is this? It sounded, it does sound like, you know, junky and a collage style. I was like imagining if this was people's entry point, and it was for a lot of people.
Yeah, people are great,
and they're so good that a junky, cluttered entry point like that could still grab everything.
Yeah. It's very interesting to see, because I was a few years earlier, my entry point was probably the Pepper 20 Years Ago Today celebrations and the Beatles on CD. And there's all these kind of entry points have kind of become more, you know, noticed in the last few years, that the anthology meant an awful lot to an awful lot of people when it was live. And I wonder how many Beatle fans have been made in the last 6 months with Get Back, that, you know, there's teenagers who are hitting that and they're going to be on podcasts or whatever in 20 years time going, well, actually, when Get Back came out, I was 14 and that blew my mind. And I don't think we appreciate that as people who've kind of already had the indoctrination, that it's a constant cycle, in as much of, you know, my kids are getting indoctrinated by Stealth. But it's, you know, there's all these little things that happen every few years in the Beatle universe that kind of push people into the rabbit hole.
I think every generation's entry point has to get longer and more difficult. It's like anthology.
Get back, you got to watch them work.
Yeah,
and then like kids 10 years from now have to listen to like all of the audio. Just
they'll be studying DNA sequences in 50 years' time. That's how they. That's where I first got into Paul.
What genes? Paul said.
well, there's the truth. So I guess the lovely thing about a project like this is you get to be very playful with it, you know, and you get to, you know, it comes back to that basic quality of the songs that, you know, musicians often talk about how the Beatles are kind of like a Rosetta Stone for each other, that you can reinterpret their music in loads of different ways. And so with this project, you kind of get to, as I was joking at the start, you kind of pre-interpret them as if, you know, that, you know, instead of moving forwards, you're moving backwards. And so did this, how did you decide which songs to use, or what was the selection process?
Well, we made like kind of a master list of ones that we were both interested in. Like Ryan wrote a bunch of songs he was interested in. I wrote a bunch of songs that I was interested in. And then we kind of cut each other's master lists down until we had 10 songs. And then somebody came in with another two songs. So really at the beginning, it was like, which of these songs can be fit into a different era? But then I think we kind of forgot about that after a while. We just felt that any of the songs could fit into whatever we were going to interpret them into. And we did change some words here and there, and we changed some of the chords, we simplified.
Yeah, that was the fun of it. It was like, well, everything can be explained by this story structure. They're some of them aren't great channelers and they screwed up a little bit and they got the melody wrong. And then they're being backed by this local Vermont band. Like we put all these story elements in that explained all the differences in a way that I hope is really fun.
Yeah, when I was reading the accompanying notes, you know, by the time I was about 70% of the way through, I was like, yeah, this all definitely happened, was kind of where I was at. I was like, this all makes a perfect internal sense. And yes, I can see why this group recorded this version of this song in 1958. It's all it's all very totally believable.
There is a definite logic to what you're doing. But what I have to say is, you know, my big disappointment with this album is that there isn't a single George Harrison track there. And
there are reasons for that. Well, Stephen, if you study the notes in depth,
I know that Ryan very deftly explains why there is no George Harrison track there. But what I'm interested in, did the notes post-date the exclusion of George Harrison, or did you just think, oh, this is I'm
okay? So I'll pull back the curtain here. So general concept, song selection, and then we really did. Rob came to Boston, and we did all of it in one weekend, and it was a joy. People just sitting around. I have a rehearsal space for the band in Charlestown, and it was a joy. People just came in and out and joined us, and then we realized what we had. I lovingly screwed up the audio. And from there, I started to say, okay, what are the details of the story that would support the audio?
Okay. So working forwards in one direction and backwards in another to get to where you need to go.
Yeah. And Rob mentioned someone else brought in two songs. And the way I got into the Beatles was, you know, I was familiar with the hits and, you know, just them. But I had a high school teacher named Mr. Morneau, who lovingly made me a 90-minute mix where he cross-faded songs and they weren't all hits. He is a huge Beatlemaniac. And stayed friends with him after high school. What's that?
He saw them live.
He saw them live in Boston. Yep. And so he sings "Please Please Me," and I saw her standing there. That's my high school teacher. Yeah.
That's pretty excellent. In terms of the album itself, I know you're saying it's a lockdown kind of concoction, but there must be a temptation to try and reproduce this as a live event, or is there?
I mean, we thought about it and talked about it a little bit, but it's like, how would we present it? You know, like, would we all be wearing robes? And
we don't have the wig budget.
I think you could do that. I think you could you just come out as was it CCS and do it in, you just need, you know, some dungarees and it's perfect. Oh.
And we had a great band too. That was the thing. We got all these really good musicians, and of course everybody knows these songs somehow, so it didn't take long to record them even. We would just like chords up and then
Rob here sings as the cult leader of the story.
Yeah.
And there's a few songs where he goes on rants in the middle of the songs.
Yes.
And those were all, we were hearing those for the first time as he's doing them. And everyone's just looking around at like a 4-minute excursion in help. Like, how long is this going? Keep going.
Yeah. I think we can work it out. There's one version where I think I went on for about 8 minutes.
Inspirational.
What really does come across is just you're clearly having a ball doing this, you know. And I mean, I take it this is pretty much all just recorded live in the studio. Yeah.
I tried. Yeah. I mean, we tried. Any audiophile is going to rip me to shreds when they hear it and then read the description, they're gonna F you, but we did try. And like, it is one mic in the middle of a room and the singer is singing into a mic going through a speaker, but it's really the sound of, you know, upwards of 10-12 people at times in one room.
Well, she was just 17, and you know what I mean, and the way she looked was way beyond compare.
As you say, the some of the chords are not, you know, not quite right or changing a little bit, and that's something I really liked, is the fact that you were kind of playing fast and loose with the melody line in some of these songs as well.
Well, you were talking, Stephen, about how it's a bit like what was it, a record home, the Neil Young, Jack White collaboration, or Letterhome, sorry, where he kind of does the same kind of one mic recording kind of setup as well.
If I don't know if you've heard that, where he's kind of like in a little booth where you could go in a like a carnival or something and record yourself, and he does a whole record like that
for his mom, right?
For his mom, yeah. And I mean, I remember it was you know, it did not get good reviews, but I actually found it incredibly moving. You know, some of the things that he was doing and the way he was presenting, and for this to be a sort of a spoof, and it's funny, and there's that element to it. Some of it actually is incredibly moving. Some of the versions of the songs you do. I mean, you know, even without reading the backstory to that version of Yesterday, that is really, you know, quite something. It's, you know, completely different from the original, but it's kind of hitting all the right spots, you know.
Yeah, that the album ends with Yesterday, and it's the Red Sox organist, Josh Cantor, is playing piano, and Noel Dorsey, our friend, who's a classically trained singer, is doing the vocals. And, both, you know, but they're both pros, basically, like, my instructions are like, you got to screw up a little bit, or just like, you know, just you got to get them. We had to work to get them a little bit off. And I get, you know, we found a slightly out of tune piano that helps. But I agree, there was something really haunting and beautiful about the end product there.
Yeah, I mean, that song in particular, you know, because you've kind of got through, there's kind of funny songs here, there's sort of it takes. I mean, the other thing is a lot of guitar songs that you kind of undermine. I mean, the obvious one is Andrew Bird Can Sing, which is just this perfect, in the original is this kind of perfect, no one's quite sure how they get that guitar sound. So you just kind of move completely away from that, keep the riff, keep the thing. And what are you playing that on, an accordion or...
Yeah, that's the same guy, the Red Sox organist. He played accordion on all the songs.
You know, and I mean, I think leading off with that track is just perfect because it lets you know exactly what you're getting. And that's before Ryan goes too nuts on the dirtying up the tapes and putting in the glitches and stuff like that.
You know? Yeah, folks, it gets worse. But it's all explained in the story.
One, two, three, four.
It's all explained in the story. It's like one of those...
Absolutely.
It's one of those multimedia experiences. You have to be listening to this while you're reading the... it's like Michael Nesmith's...
Oh, The Prison, yeah.
It's a novel and a record, and you have to read...
Oh, really? I'm going to check that out right away. Wow. Okay, I sing two. I sing Across the Universe and All You Need Is Love.
Yeah. I knew that. I knew that.
Nice work.
Correct.
And Rob, you kind of do two characters in a lot of songs.
Yeah. Yeah, I do Bird Can Sing, because there's the band, the guys, the kind of country band, and that's Bird Can Sing, and what's the other one?
Is it We Can Work It Out?
We Can Work It Out, I do, but that's as the cult leader. We Can Work It Out, help.
Right.
And I'm looking through you.
Right.
That's a great arrangement. This kind of like, it kind of suddenly swerves into the crescendo from A Day in the Life or something in the middle of that.
Oh, yeah, I didn't even think of that. That's a good reference point. Yeah, that's what we meant.
Oh, cool.
And then...
I keep going into these noise sections, which is, very much like Day in the Life, which I never thought of.
But. Yeah. Oh, I was just going to say, one other vocalist is a fan of my band, Holly of the Hills. His daughter came in. I put basically on Twitter, I was like, does anyone have a child? Anyone have a child? You know, the way all good tweets start. Who would, you know, it doesn't have to be great singing, but is willing to sing. And this really wonderful young woman named Avery came in. It took her a while. I mean, she comes into a room of guys who have been there for 48 hours, and we just had to work and just have fun with her. And she sings In My Life.
Very good. That, I'm glad you didn't get arrested for that tweet. Not like that song. This is a song where I think your version is better than the original. I'm quite happy to put that on the record, because it's that kind of, even before I read the notes, I was thinking, well, it's just Buddy Holly. It's just and I think, how did you get from that very, I think, very kind of clumsy arrangement that maybe Babies in Black to think, okay, yeah, Peggy Sue, we just.
Right. Well, that reminds me, that's another vocalist. I keep forgetting how big the team was. Our friend Lear came in with that idea. He was like, let's do Babies in Black. It's secretly a Buddy Holly ripoff, and we'll lean in.
It's perfect. It's fantastic. And of course, Buddy Holly is all over, I don't know what record that's on in America, but it's on Beatles for Sale. And there are, it's got Words of Love, and you know, so Buddy Holly is on that we album. So I just thought maybe that was the connection. But
we're learning a lot.
It's the serendipity of putting Beatles out into the universe, all the connections that kind of arise that you don't really see coming, you know?
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
That's right.
One of the things I was wondering, you know, when you listen to this is, you know, what other band would this work for? You know, like, the as we kind of said earlier, the Beatles kind of have this kind of universality. But I was thinking, well, who else could the Echo Lake Home for the Potentially Clairvoyant have channeled in 1958 that would have made such an impact? It's kind of hard to, I don't know whether that crossed your mind about, well, if we did this again, we'd do X, Y, or Z, or whether it's kind of a unique property of the Beatles that you can throw this kind of project at Beatles songs.
Yeah, I mean, that was the tough thing. I think from the beginning, it was always, we have to do this with the Beatles. I mean, we thought that when we had the earlier podcast idea, if we changed the band to something else, or even a fake band, that maybe we could do it. But the whole idea was to do the Beatles thing. I mean, there, of course, you could do like any other big act, like David Bowie or Rolling Stones, maybe even. But there's just something about the Beatles that is so iconic and easy to manipulate into different sort of ideas that might be harder with other bands.
Yeah, I think they have transcended band and they are myth status. And I think it's easier to play with myths. And so that's kind of what we're doing. Yeah. And by the end of the weekend, we had so much fun doing this. We did. Remember, we're packing up and we're like, what other band could we do?
Yeah. We could talk about
it. But it's hard to think up. And, you know, the Beatles worked perfectly for it.
I mean, that's a very good way of putting it, that the Beatles have this myth about them. And so if you're creating a myth yourselves with this 1958 premise, then you can actually pull the myths, you can bring the myths together, because it's using the same part of your brain in a way.
That was intentional. This time I get to say it and really mean it. We did mean that.
Good.
And is there another couple of reels we're going to find this time next year, or
could be?
Well, let's see. We'll see how it sells, Stephen.
we'll see if Apple hits you with a cease and desist. Or
yeah. Come on, just let the kids have fun.
You mentioned there in passing, I guess, can we call it the main gig, Hallelujah the Hills, your band. I suppose we should just get an idea of, you know, for people who don't know the band, you know, where they come from and what, I guess, like many musicians, you were hit hard by the pandemic, and this is obviously one of the spin-off projects from it, but what are you guys up to at the minute?
We're busy. We're kind of forming what it is, but we're just writing lots of new songs right now. Like, we've been around since late 2005 from Boston. And we were on tour with a new album. We released a new album in late 2019, and we're touring it in March 2020. We're literally, you know, we played till the very last night, where it was like, this band is now a safety hazard, go home. And so, and then last summer we were like everyone was like, it's over, we're back. And we played an outdoor show and it felt so good. And then you bring it back in. But we have stayed busy, and we, you know, even when we're not making music, we're cracking each other up on text thread. It's like, it's like we can find ways to, as long as we're bothering each other, the band's going to be just fine. Talk about the things that were canceled for you.
I'm come from more of the theater world. So, yeah, I had a lot of stuff that was canceled. But right before the pandemic, I was commissioned to write this long country music opera that was premiering in Germany. So I got lucky in that I was able to write this 4-hour long piece, you know, in my apartment, annoying my wife a little bit. But and then it finally premiered in Vienna.
Oh, wow.
Last summer. But now stuff got canceled again in the winter, so it keeps going back and forth.
Is that something that's going to tour, or is it just...
Yeah, it's touring. It's going to be in Athens in June, and then up in northern Norway in Harstad, also in June.
What's it called?
Bert Torito.
Okay. Hmm. Are these big country music opera centers of excellence in...
Well, I mean, I work with this company, Nature Theater of Oklahoma. We've made like a bunch of different projects, some of them with music. There was one we made where we told the life story of our sound designer in 10 different episodes, and it was called Life and Times. And that was like the first piece was just, it's told over the phone. So she told her entire life story. So the first one is like youth, and it's 3.5 hours and all on the ukulele. Then the second one is like teenage years, and it goes up to the present day. So in the end, it was like a almost 24-hour long piece.
And we struggle to get a podcast out, you know, once a week. It's,
I know, I'm beginning to feel a bit lazy, Stephen. It's not a good place to be.
And hey, you guys got some Boston love recently. Boston
Global, yes.
Article about Great Beatles podcasts. It was great to see you in there.
That was very strange. That was very, very weird. I just assumed that you had pulled some strings there, Ryan.
I know the writer, but he independently loves your show. So,
well, that's very good. It was very strange. It was very strange.
Yeah, when these things happen, you kind of, you know, I think we forget people listen, Stephen, sometimes.
That's true. You know? That's very true. That's very true. But what one thing I wanted to ask Ryan specifically, because I'm going deep on the notes that you've done, and you mentioned this interview with Lennon where he talks about, you know, psychic abilities and language is such a clumsy thing, and you don't that's the one bit you didn't put a footnote in to say where that came from, but that's from the Morris Hindle interview with the student that kind of rocked up and in 1968. That's a pretty obscure thing to pick up on. But were you just kind of doing the deep dive research on Lennon mentioning language and ESP and
I was doing that. I mean, it was familiar that he was kind of open to those ideas for sure. But you know, I think I was listening to One Sweet Dream podcast, Diana, and I think she referenced it, and then I think I had her point me to it. I mean, I'm a true Beatles fanatic. I listen to a bunch of these podcasts. It's so strange how we're on another upward wave of that the band's popularity. Do you guys experience that with the show?
Yeah, I'd say the Get Back experience has been totally wild, and to actually see, you know, the Beatles were always mainstream, but to actually see them kind of zeitgeisty and mainstream at the same time, and to actually, you know, see, you know, the Get Back on the side of a bus and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, kind of the reappropriation of the Let It Be album certainly it's in the UK charts. It was kind of hanging around the top 20 for most of the end of last year. I guess we've seen people reaching out to us and followers online and all the rest. That's all taken a bump at the end of last year, you know?
Yeah, I think it's one of the benefits of the pandemic is that people were kind of locked down. They're prepared to listen to anything. So our podcast is...
That's the category I set, to listen to just anything.
And that's the audience we're searching for with this album. Those who will listen to anything.
dovetails perfectly. But I think there's definitely got to be scope for, you know, another hidden reel somewhere. And, you know, I think there's scope for, you know, lectures and broadcasts. And,
he did an album just of lectures.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think absolutely.
Oh,
I think
you know what? We have to do George Harrison. You're right. We should do some Ringo and Harrison. Opposite.
Oh yeah, one that's just Ringo and Harrison.
Yeah. Exactly. Well, I think you know, Don't Pass Me By is perhaps that's too obvious. That's already a kind of nod to the style. So maybe that's a little bit
right.
A little bit too obvious. But
I think All Things Must Pass, all that album feels like it's of the dream world. Maybe that needs to be channeled somewhere,
oh,
you know?
Yeah.
There's no physical release of this?
No, it's just going to exist digitally. I mean, those, I would love it if I could press those liner notes. We just don't know how many people are going to be into this. And that's fine. We truly just had so much fun making it, and we'll see what kind of life it lives. And that's kind of it. You know?
Good stuff. Well, then we need enough people to download this, to listen to it, to get volume 2, to get the band out on the road. This could run and run, Ryan.
you're seeing cottage industry in my future.
But what I would say is, what the world does not need is another Beatles podcast. So just stay away from that. But otherwise, anything else?
We dodged the bullet, Rob.
Yeah.
You talk about the theremin.
Oh yeah.
Is there a theremin on this, or is this? Yeah.
Well, it's the. It's Norwegian wood.
Yeah. I was gonna say that's probably the most radically overhauled track.
Yeah.
Apart from Rob's, improvisation in the middle of Help, but.
I mean, the theremin sounds like such a futuristic instrument, but it's super old, and so that got me thinking to tie it to this project. And then our friend Tyler is a theremin player, and I was like, would you just mess around with pick a Beatles song and hint at the melody. And then we overlay it with one of Rob's speeches. And it's a confounding track.
And are all of these speeches just improvised on the spot? Or were you...
Oh, yeah. They're completely improvised on the spot. And they changed, like different takes. They were totally different things, you know.
Yeah.
Okay. No script.
It was great. I loved seeing Rob just take off on these things. It was really.
It was almost. Would you say it was almost like he was channeling somebody? You know.
Oh my God.
The band would be sitting there waiting to come back in too, and sort of, they didn't know when I was gonna shoot back into the song, and then of course, as I said, one we can work it out. It went on for like. Eight or nine
well,
minutes.
That's the extended mix. Is that that's a bonus track for the reissue? That's already working on the anthology version here. You know, you're storing up. And are there other songs that you recorded that didn't make the cut?
To be honest, no. We used every part of the buffalo, as they say. I think every we were like, we have to get through these 10 songs in 2 days. It was actually. It wasn't a lot of leisure time. Like, I would run and get us pizza. You know, yeah, we had scheduled guests, like, get this person in and let's go to the piano. It was it was super fun, but it was also like a packed weekend.
Okay, you're making it clear it was work.
Yeah, that's right. We worked hard.
It wasn't just dicking around and, it was.
Certainly not, no.
Certainly not. Definitely not.
Yeah.
Okay, well, look. We should say that the name of the album is The Music of the Beatles as channeled in 1958 by the Echo Lake Home for the Potentially Clairvoyant. It is available from April the 1st, raised eyebrows, on Bandcamp. And we'll put a link to the album in the description of this podcast as well. And, as we've kind of said throughout all this, you kind of have to, you can listen to the album on its own, which is a total blast. But if you listen in conjunction with the very, very, very deep and explanatory sleeve notes, which make it all seem utterly believable. I think it's Ryan and Robert who are the shams. I actually believe in 1958 clairvoyant, I don't know what to believe anymore, Stephen. We're through the looking glass. That's kind of the main problem. Well, look, guys, we really want to thank you for your time today and thank you for doing this project. It's an absolute blast and we hope we can point a lot of people in the direction of listening to it. But thanks for joining us. That's thanks to Ryan Walsh.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to Robert Johansson. Thanks, Robert.
Thank you.
And so I guess well, that leaves us to just wrap up that we're available in all the usual places. We're on the Nothing Is Real website, nothingisrealpod.com, Twitter at BeatlesPod, the Nothing Is Real Facebook group that Stephen's at. I want to thank all our Acast Plus subscribers. But for now, my name's Jason Carty.
My name's Stephen Cockcroft.
And this has been Nothing Is Real. Thanks for listening.
Rob, you think they're buying this?